Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, RCVS and European Veterinary Specialist in Neurology, Peter Smith. Thank you, Peter. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm assuming that everything's going smoothly and that you can all hear me nice and clearly. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to come and join us today. So what I was going to talk about today was the conservative management of disc disease, which I've rather glibly described as neurology without the knife. But that's really what it's all about. So without further ado, what do we mean? What sort of problems do we see associated with intervertebral disc disease in animals? Probably one of the most obvious ones would be that animals will often have neck or back pain. In many cases, this can be really quite severe. So you can see a classic posture of a dog with severe neck pain here. It's difficult to convey in a photograph, but it looks very rigid round about its neck. You'll sometimes see lameness as well. You don't necessarily have to have focal pain along the back, but if you have a nerve root pinched, and if that nerve root is providing some sensory supply to one of the legs, then animals will often appear lame. And that can be severe, and it can be to the extent that they will chew or bite their feet, or that they may hold one of their feet off the ground. And perhaps the more obvious things that we think of with this disease are dogs that can be parapretic, where just the back legs are affected, or tetrapretic, where all four legs are affected. So there's quite a range of presentations that we see with intervertebral disc disease. And there is also quite a range of different types of disc disease. Now, historically, these were categorized as either type 1 or type 2 intervertebral disc disease. So in type 1 intervertebral disc disease, you have degeneration of the nucleus pulposus of the disc. So this is a cartilaginous, well-hydrated center to the disc, which enables it to act as a cushion between adjacent vertebrae. And a lot of breeds of dog, particularly the chondrodystrophic breeds, some of the fluid is lost from this cartilage. It degenerates at a very young age, sometimes as early as 12 months old. And that means that they are predisposed to the central, the nucleus extruding up through the annulus and into the spinal canal here. So you can see that quite clearly on an MRI scan, and sometimes you can have quite a marked extrusion, as you can see in this dog here. So this is a midline sagittal T2 weighted image from a dog with type 1 intervertebral disc disease. And you can see that there's marked compression of the spinal cord. So you've got spinal cord running along here, and you've got a marked compression caused by this extruded disc here. So that's your classic type 1 intervertebral disc disease. You see it in a wide range of dogs. Only this morning I had a look at a dog which was only just over two years old, which had severe neck pain from type 1 intervertebral disc disease. But you can see it right up into old age as well. You will also, as well as the, probably the commonest site that you'll see that will be in the thoracolumbar region. But you also get cervical disc disease, as you can see in this picture here. So you've got a large extruded disc here, and you can see there's very marked compression of the spinal cord there. And if you imagine that you've got exiting between each adjacent pair of spinal bones, you've got a nerve root, one on each side of the vertebra. That nerve root is also going to be compressed by that. And not surprisingly, that's very painful. So even though you have a very severe compression here, the only clinical sign that you might see with this dog might well be severe neck pain. And it's possible for it to not have any detectable neurologic deficits when you examine it, even though it has that very marked compression. And that's the way it'll tend to manifest itself. So type 2 disease, this is where you have protrusion of the annulus. So you've got the annulus fibrosis, the tough fibrous surround to the nucleus of the disc. And this is something that typically occurs in larger breed dogs, but not exclusively. It does occur in small breed dogs as well. And it often occurs, or probably more typically anyway, in elderly dogs. And you get a progressive degeneration and thickening of the annulus. And it can bulge up sometimes on one side or the other, sometimes right in the midline, where it can cause quite significant compression of the spinal cord. And you can see this on another mid-sagittal view through the spinal cord of this elderly dog. So you can see the spinal cord running along here, and you've got this marked protrusion from this disc. So they're the conventional two types of disc that we've always talked about. But I think increasingly you will recognize, and we will recognize, that discs cause problems in slightly different types of way. So some people would describe what they would call a type 3 disc. This has got various abbreviations and various different names. I think it's fine to call it type 3, but some people don't particularly like that term. Other people would call it an acute nucleus pulposus extrusion without residual compression. And so you get great long acronyms that people will tend to use to describe it. But fundamentally, they're talking about the same thing, which is a problem of it's not a degenerate disc. It's a problem that you have with a disc where you have you still have the gelatinous nucleus and you still have an intact annulus fibrosus, which isn't causing compression. But under extreme activity and extreme forces, the nucleus can rupture and it will explode up through the annulus and it will go into the spinal canal where it will hit the spinal cord. So that's a non-degenerate disc, which is rupturing and causing an explosive contusive damage to the spinal cord. And I think if you look at the MRI scan that I've got here, you can imagine the path that this has taken. This is a T2 weighted scan. So the nucleus here is white because fluid is white on that type of scan, and that tells you that you've got a non-degenerate disc there. If you look very carefully, I think you can appreciate that the nucleus is slightly smaller than these adjacent ones here. And I think if you also look carefully, you can imagine that this has ruptured and it's exploded, and you can almost see the angle that it's shooting up through the cord there. So this will explode and it will go up through the dura, through the spinal cord, and out the top of it, and it causes very severe damage. Now, discs will cause problems in slightly different ways as well, which you'll be familiar with. You can get discospondylitis. In this country, the UK, this would most commonly be a bacterial infection of the disc, where you'll get infection of the disc and the adjacent spinal bones, hence the name discospondylitis. You'll often see areas of erosion if you look very carefully. It's never going to be very easy to convey this on a PowerPoint presentation. You really need good quality x-rays to see this, but you should be able to see areas of erosion, and you also get new bone formation as a reaction to the infection there. So typically that would be a bacterial infection that spreads hematogenously and settles out in the disc and leads to a persistent and sometimes very difficult to treat infection. We also see this slightly unusual phenomenon, the discal cyst. This is where you have again, it's not the greatest term in the world because it's not actually a cyst, but it's where you have non-degenerate material extruding into the spinal canal. So this can be very gelatinous in a lot of cases, and you can get really quite marked compression of the spinal cord. I think if you look carefully at this, if you look at the height of the spinal cord here, where it's normal, and compare it with what's going on here over the site of this so-called discal cyst, it's down to about probably less than 50%. So you can get a very, very dramatic compression with that condition. You don't see it very often, and it's something that I need to be aware of most of the time. I think it tends to manifest itself in a fairly predictable way, which is that animals will become tetraparetic or paraparetic, depending on what site of the body is affected. And interestingly, it tends not to be a particularly painful condition. So what's the effect of disc disease? Well, I think this is illustrated to a certain extent by the video that I'm showing there. So that's where you've got Po from Kung Fu Panda landing on the unfortunate Thailand's head. And you can see that as it does that, if you imagine that Po's bum is the disc and Thailand is the spinal cord there, the disc causes compression as it lands, and then as it moves away again. the compression is alleviated. Now, in some cases, that compression stays, and in some cases, the compression is completely alleviated after the event, such as with a periacute disc extrusion. However, and really, in trying to as well as the compression, you also have contusion. So even though the compression may be alleviated after the initial disc problem, there will still be bruising. So there's always going to be a degree of compression, and there is always going to be a degree of contusion. And it's really the relative contribution of each that determines whether you're going to be able to get away with conservative management or whether you might need surgery. So I'm sure you can imagine, if you have a contusive injury, conservative management is going to be fine. If you don't have anything squashing the spinal cord, it's unlikely to be necessary for you to get involved in doing an operation. Surgery might be necessary if you have some instability, because you might have movement of the vertebral column, which is causing repeatable contusion and which causes damage to the spinal cord and further neurologic deterioration, and can also cause repeated pain as well. So you will sometimes need surgery when you have a contusive injury, just to provide stability and stop the problem from recurring. But the main reason that you're thinking about surgery is if you have a static significant compression either of the spinal cord or of the nerve root. However, and this is an important one and probably more relevant for today, you can get away with conservative management in some cases, even if there's quite a significant compression. And that's important because a lot of clients have financial constraints that prevents them from being able to go for the surgical option. And you might also make a judgment, irrespective of financial constraints, that decompressive surgery is not necessarily the right thing for that individual animal. If you have intercurrent disease, if there are other problems to worry about that may be contributing to the overall disability, or perhaps there's a more severe disease elsewhere in the body that you need to worry more about, you have to take a balanced decision. So the classic example of contusion without compression is this periacute disc extrusion, the type 3 disc extrusion, the acute non-compressive disc extrusion, whatever you want to call it. It's the same thing. It's a non-degenerate disc which is rupturing, and it's causing severe bruising of the overlying spinal cord. So you can see this quite clearly here. The hyperintensity within the spinal cord there, that you can see that white patch, that's an area of contusion, and it's caused by this disc here rupturing upwards into the spinal canal. And if you look at the transverse sections there, you can see this area of contusion here. Now, what you can also appreciate about this, which is quite a relevant point, is that it's slightly lateralized. So these animals often have slightly lateralized clinical signs. Typically, they're periacute onset. You can imagine why that is. It's because they're typical under extreme stresses. The classic history that we'll tend to see is that dogs are out running. Perhaps they'll run into a tree. Probably more likely it's doing things like jumping for a frisbee, chasing after a ball, suddenly turning. The owners might not see it. Sometimes they disappear around a corner, disappear into some trees. They hear a sharp cry as the dog shouts out because they're initially painful, but they're subsequently not painful. So if the owners do see it, they'll often see their dog suddenly cry out and become paralyzed. If they don't see it, they'll hear them cry out, and then the next thing they see is their dog dragging their legs behind them. And this is the classic presentation. This is classically the way that they look, because they tend to have lateralized clinical signs. And if you look at this dog, you can see it's got relatively good function in its left pelvic limb. And he's doing a very good job of putting most of the weight onto his thoracic limbs so that he can get about well. But there's very poor function in that right back leg. Now, this is variable. Some dogs will be completely paraplegic, but it's not unusual, even in paraplegic dogs, it's not unusual that you can detect some lateralization of the clinical signs when you carry out your examination. So that's a useful clue that that might be what you're going on. Now, on the basis that probably a lot of your decision making for conservative management may be based on financial restrictions, it's worth contemplating how you go about reaching a presumptive diagnosis without the need for expensive ancillary diagnostic tests such as MRI. So how do you have a significant clinical suspicion that you might have a dog which has a pericute disc extrusion? Well, for me, you just go through the same sort of diagnostic process that you all do every day with every single condition. You always take shortcuts to this because you get used to seeing certain things. But fundamentally, if you have a difficult case, you're always thinking about what the history is, the results of your clinical examination, what findings you have with your neurological examination, which enables you to make an accurate localization of the problem. And by doing that, you can draw up something, a differential diagnosis list, and decide on what further diagnostic tests you need. Now, if you've got something like a pericute disc where you've got a paraplegic dog, you may be trying to get away without doing further diagnostic tests because you don't want to spend an awful lot of money on an MRI scan. But you still need to go through this same process. And the key part of that is the neurological examination, because this has a massive impact on the differential diagnosis list. If you know the site that's affected in the nervous system, you can make a pretty good stab, or you can often narrow it down an awful lot, so that you're only left with one or two or perhaps three realistic differential diagnoses. I'm not going to go into depth into the neurological examination because I'm sure you've heard that before, and it's the sort of thing you can pick up on from books, but it's worth just touching on very briefly. We've got some interesting formatting here with these lines around the boxes here, which are not quite supposed to be there, so I apologize about that, but it doesn't affect the information that you get from this. So as a reminder, when you see an animal with spinal cord disease, what you're trying to do is, first of all, ask the question, does it have a neurological problem? Or could it be orthopedic, for example? If you think it has a neurological problem, which part of the nervous system is affected? So can you go through your neurological examination and you're trying to work out which of these segments of the nervous system, the spinal cord, you think is affected? And remember, the way that we divide these up, the only two bits that you need to remember are the bits where the neurons for the thoracic limb are, which is C6 to T2, and where the low motor neurons supplying the pelvic limb are, which is this region L4 to S3. Everything else is just the bits in between. So that's the rationale behind dividing the nervous system up into these different segments. And then we carry out an examination that should look a little bit like this. So here I've got a dog which is presented, although it might not look it, this dog is paraplegic. It's interesting that it's still able to stand, but it is still paraplegic, has no voluntary movement in its back legs. So there we're testing the postural responses in the thoracic limbs. So that's conscious proprioception is good there. That conscious proprioception is absent in the pelvic limbs. So already, I've just paused that a sec, already you have a clue as to what's going on. You've got a dog that's presented paraplegic. Its four limbs appear to be okay, but its pelvic limbs are abnormal. So already we can say that the segments of spinal cord that are pretty much unlikely. So far we're thinking that C1 to C5 and C6 to T2 aren't likely to be affected. So remember, for this, for proprioception to work, that sensory information from the foot that indicates it's in a funny position has to get all the way up the leg, right the way up the spinal cord, and to the opposite side of the brain. The brain has to then recognize that the foot is in an abnormal position, sends information to the motor cortex, which then decides to put the foot into a sensible place to bear weight, and that information has to go right the way back down the spinal cord, back to the leg, make the muscles work so that the foot is placed back into a normal position. So for conscious proprioception to work, the nerves, the spinal cord, and the brain have got to be working normally. So already we're thinking we probably have a problem affecting either T3 to L3 or L4 to S3. So the way that we'd go on and examine that further would be to test the reflexes in the limbs. A little bit interesting shot of the dog just in lateral recumbency there, which we'll come back to in a second. Interesting posture. And then we test the spinal reflexes. That's me testing the patellar reflex, which is intact. There are various other reflexes, tendon tap reflexes that you can test. That's me testing the cranial tibial reflex, and that's the gastrocnemius reflex. Often don't see much of a reflex when you test those two, but sometimes by putting my finger over the tendon, I can feel a small twitch within the tendon. Obviously deciding not to do it in the front leg there because it's got a big catheter in. And now the withdrawal reflex, which you'll remember is a spinal reflex. So it's got a good withdrawal, all the reflexes are intact. What that's telling you is that these reflex loops that govern those reflexes are intact. So the sensory nerves have got to be working, the sensory receptors have to work, the sensory nerves have got to work, the segments of spinal cord that are involved in innervating the pelvic limb need to work, so that's L4 to S3. And then the motor neurons and the motor nerves and the muscles themselves have to work. So a defect anywhere within that reflex loop will cause you to lose the reflex. But if the reflex is intact, it is telling you that that reflex loop is intact. It tells you nothing about the connection to the brain. So remember, the withdrawal reflex is totally different from assessing sensory perception, i.e. whether there is any pain perception in the leg. But by doing that, what we've established is that whereas before that, we knew that we had a lesion between T3 and L3 or L4 to S3, we now think we have a lesion between T3 and L3. So if we're systematic about it, we can work out where the most likely site of the problem is. There are, however, a couple of pitfalls in localization that are particularly pertinent for dogs that present with per-acute onset paralysis. And one of those you saw there in the video, you can see it in the video, and I think you can see it in this picture that you have here, which is that the thoracic limbs are really quite rigidly extended, slightly hyperextended. And this is the Schiff-Sherrington response. And you get this, even though you have a lesion between T3 and L3, you get this impact on the extensor tone. So what you have actually is you have a population of nerve cells within the T3 to L3 segments, which project cranially to inhibit extensor tone. So if you create a lesion here, you alleviate that inhibition and you have an increase in extensor tone. And it's very easy actually to look at this and assume that that the lesion is in the neck because there is this increase in tone. But actually, if you look at the postural responses, they're completely normal. They might have slightly more difficulty performing them because they have an increase in tone, but they're still normal because those segments of spinal cord are normal. The other thing that we need to be aware of is this phenomenon of spinal shock. Now, this tends not to be a big deal in animals compared with humans. In humans, it's a big problem because we're a lot more advanced than animals are. And what happens is that if you cut the spinal cord in half, the immediate impact is to cause a reduction, you cause a flaccid paralysis distal to that. And that applies to both animals and to people. So if I cut the spinal cord here in this region, T3 to L3, the immediate impact will be flaccid paralysis of the back legs. Now that goes against the sort of conventional way that you might look at things or what you might read in textbooks, because you're effectively creating an upper motor neuron lesion here, which a textbook might argue should lead to an increase in tone down here. The thing is, that's a slight simplification of what actually happens. And the reason that spinal shock is not such a problem in animals is because it tends to be very brief. It will go on for a long period of time in people, but in animals it's very brief, often only a few hours, or even less than that. But it can be useful, it's important for people in practice because you will often see these cases very soon after the injury has occurred. Someone will tend to pick the dog up, rush it straight down to the vets, and what you see is an animal that's paralyzed and might have very, very poor tone in its back legs and might not have any reflexes in its back legs. And that can occur even though you have a lesion between T3 and L3 because you have a loss of tone and a loss of reflexes here. If you re-examine that animal later, even a couple of hours later, it can change quite significantly. So be prepared to get caught out, and also be prepared to have to do serial examinations so that you can be confident in understanding the site of the lesion. So having got to this stage, you know the classic history, the dog chasing a ball, jumping up, crying out, suddenly paralyzed. You've done your examination. What you find is you've got slightly asymmetric clinical signs. It's a non-progressive problem. They're very severely affected when it first happens. And then if anything, you can get significant improvement. Sometimes over a period of a couple of hours, you can get a significant change in the condition, as well as changes in the neurological examination occurring over that first 24 to 48 hours. And you also might have a typical localization. So for me, the commonest site that will tend to be affected for dogs with pericute disc extrusions is round about the thoracolumbar junction, which makes sense because that's the part of the body where there's quite a lot of flexion and extension in the dog. And that's the area where the discs are likely to be under the most severe stress. So if you put all these factors together, you can come up with a pretty convincing argument that you're confronted by a dog which has a pericute disc extrusion. Of course, in an ideal world, you want to do an MRI scan because you want to exclude the possibility that you have any instability or any compression. But if you've got someone who can't afford to do those diagnostic tests, you can make a pretty good conservative judgment, a pretty good judgment that conservative management is going to be the appropriate way to go for that dog. So what do we mean by conservative management? Well, medication is obviously the first thing that you might tend to think of. And the first thing that people will tend to think of might be steroids. Now, steroids, perhaps a few years ago, maybe seemed like quite a good idea. But increasingly now, we're starting to question that. And I think the majority of people are pretty comfortable with the idea that steroids are not a good, are not indicated for dogs with acute spinal cord injury, or indeed for people with acute spinal cord injury. So what was a good idea a few years ago is maybe not such a good idea now. And of course, with dogs, you get a lot of side effects. It'll make them eat more, drink more, and then put on weight. Now, I accept that you're not talking about long-term steroids when we're looking at acute spinal cord injury. The arguments were always for using a very high dose of steroids for a short period of time. However, they will also have side effects. They can cause severe gastrointestinal upset, and they can increase the risk of infection as well. A lot of this work goes back to a big human study that was done in North America, the NASCIS 2, the North American Spinal Cord Injury Study, in which they used very high doses of methylprednisolone. And for what seems likely to have been statistical aberrations, a conclusion came out of that actually using steroids was beneficial and did slightly improve outcome. I think the problem is that there were statistical aberrations in that study that meant it was probably an erroneous conclusion. But even in spite of that, the improvements were very, very minor. And there were significant side effects from the point of view of increased risk of infection. And the other thing is that in animals, we've tended not to follow the same protocol that was used in those people either. So overall, for me, steroids are not the right way to go. I think the adverse effects far outweigh any benefit, and any benefit seems very unlikely. There's nothing to suggest it. So steroids are not the way to go for me. I think the only thing that I would do really is focus on medication using conventional analgesics if you feel that dogs need it. And actually, when you're looking at something like a pericute disc extrusion, they tend not to be painful. You can't say that universally because I've occasionally come across dogs who have seemed like they're a little bit uncomfortable. But on the whole, it's rare, and I don't think they even need analgesics. And instead, the main focus that we tend to put on these cases is to embark on physiotherapy, and actually physiotherapy getting started as quickly as possible. Of course, this is one of the reasons that you want to make sure that in an ideal world, you would do an MRI scan to get a definitive diagnosis, because then you'd know that you don't have significant compression and you'd know that you don't have any instability there. So you'd be much more comfortable with being pretty vigorous and starting physiotherapy as quickly as possible, which you might not be if you had a significant compression there. So what do we mean by physiotherapy? What are we embarking on when we start with physiotherapy? Well, what we're aiming to do is to try and improve muscle tone. I've already said that muscle tone will often be diminished in these dogs, even though they might have a thoracolumbar, a T3L3 lesion. So it's important to improve muscle tone because that's what helps to get the dog standing up again. So there's various things that we can do for that. We want to try and maintain joint and muscle mobility. Joints will stiffen up and muscles will stiffen up if they're not used. And there's no good having a dog which makes a good recovery from its spinal cord injury, only to then discover that you've allowed all its joints to seize up and its muscles to tighten up. So it's important to try and maintain muscles, keep the blood flowing, and get them maintain flexibility as much as possible. At a more advanced level, you're trying to restore balance and improve proprioception. You're trying to maximize any awareness that the animals do have of whereabouts their feet are. So you need, you know, the nature of the nervous system is that it reinforces circuits that you're using. So if you have any residual nerve spinal cord function, you want to maximize that so that you reinforce it and strengthen it, which will help to further improve proprioception and an awareness of where the feet are. And obviously the key thing is you want to restore and improve voluntary movement. You want to get them up and route and walking as quickly as possible. But don't forget, there are other general nursing aspects to these dogs as well. It's not such a problem if you have a dog that's just a little bit weak in one leg, but these problems do occur affecting the neck as well. And you can have a tetraparetic or tetraplegic patient from this sort of condition. And managing that is important from a neurological perspective, but you also need to be aware of nursing complications. You need to get them up, moving them from side to side. You need to make sure that they don't develop bed sores. And you also need to get them standing up to reduce the chances of getting nasty complications like pneumonia. And one of the best ways of doing that, by far, is to get the dogs standing up and moving around outside. And physiotherapists are a big help in doing that. It's hard work with a tetraparetic dog, but it's well worth it, and it does have a significant impact on reducing the incidence of complications in these cases. So this is the sort of thing you'll do with stretching. You can do it with cats, you can do it with dogs. And it's all about maintaining the mobility of the joints. And just simple passive stretches like this will make a big difference. This is an example of just using improving a passive range of motion in animals. And again, it illustrates that cats, which you might typically think of as being very difficult to manage, you can do it. You're just gradually, progressively flexing the joints and extending them so that you're maintaining the range of movement, you're maintaining the blood flow, you're stretching tendons and ligaments. You need to be a little bit careful and make sure you don't have an osteoarthritic joint here. But even that is probably going to benefit from a bit of gentle physiotherapy, as long as you don't overdo it and cause pain. We can also do things to stimulate muscle tone. So if you're trying to, if you provide sensory stimulation to a muscle which has poor muscle tone, you will tend to increase the tone in that muscle. You can do things like, you can do vibration, you can do tapping, percussion, and that helps to improve the muscle tone. You can take that a step further as well. I apologize that this video is over on one side. I tried to rotate it, and every time that I did it, it mucked up the formatting and made it unwatchable, really. But I think you can see what we're doing there. We're using surface electrodes to stimulate the muscles. And that's a useful thing to do, because by making the muscle work, a working muscle is much less likely to atrophy quickly. If you don't use a muscle, it will atrophy very quickly. This is a convenient way of trying to stimulate it and increase muscle tone and avoid the marked muscle wastage that you can see in cases where you have prolonged paraplegia. So how does spinal cord recover? What's actually going on when these dogs are improving? Well, some of the damage that occurs at the time of the injury can be temporary. Not all the axons that stop working will be permanently damaged. So some of those, as the blood supply starts to recover and electric potentials are restored, normal electric working potentials are restored across the membrane, then they can start working again. And similarly, some of the damaged neurons can recover. Not all of them, some of them will be permanently damaged and they're not going to come back. There is no new generation of neurons in the nervous system, in the central nervous system, sorry. But some of them can be temporarily damaged and gradually start to recover as blood supplies return and metabolism returns to normal. You can also get remyelination of demyelinated axons. So some of the axons that are injured may just lose their myelin sheath, but still remain intact. So they're not going to work very effectively if they don't have their myelin sheath, because remember, that's what helps them to, that's what bring, that's what enables saltatory conduction. That's what enables the rapid conduction that ensures you have an efficient nervous system. But myelin can be reformed. So as they become remyelinated, they can start to work again. But one of the other things that can happen is that you can get a sort of reactivation of some of the intrinsic control mechanisms within the spinal cord that control locomotion. And I guess to understand this, you need to have a little bit of insight into what enables a dog and a person to walk. And this is one of the things that's going to be very important for animals which are paraplegic, because a lot of this damage is not going to be recoverable. And if you've got a paraplegic animal, you may be relying to a very large extent, sorry, excuse me, you're going to be relying to a very large extent on this reactivation and sort of remodeling of spinal cord circuits that permit locomotion. So, how do animals walk? Well, actually, a lot of it is controlled by what you call a central pattern generator, which resides within the spinal cord. And this is a series of integrated circuits that take sensory information and use that to modify the activity of neurons in the lumbosacral plexus. So you have patterned activity within these nerve cells, which is then modified by sensory input coming back from the legs, and is also obviously modified by conscious input, so that you have an animal that makes a conscious decision to do something with its leg, to step over a log, or to jump over a wall, and that obviously has a big impact on this. But these are very powerful circuits that you can that can be modified during recovery to try and enhance recovery following spinal cord injury. Now, this is probably quite well illustrated, or it seems to me it's quite well illustrated anyway, by this experimental study which describes some treadmill training. That's a bit of a bamboozling figure to look at first instance, but actually it's probably a lot more simple than it appears to be. The ones to focus on are these four down here. So what you've got here is the pattern, the tread pattern of a normal animal walking along. So you've got the left hind limb here, then the right hind limb, left forelimb, right forelimb. Now, if you have an animal which has got an incomplete spinal cord injury, obviously the right forelimb and the left forelimb are working completely normally here, alternating stepping movements along, which is illustrated by the dashed lines, whereas the back legs are dragging behind them. So you've got them just dragging behind in a continuous line. What you find is that if you do treadmill training on these experimental animals, with time, so 16 days later here, you've already got back to an alternating pattern of stepping in the hind limbs. And if you look to a little bit later on, it's become slightly neater. The fuzzy lines that you can see up here, what that's showing is that's electrical activity in the muscles of the pelvic limbs, and it's illustrating that you have a gradual restoration. If you look at broadly at the pattern that you have here and here, this pattern here corresponds much more closely to this than this does. So as time goes on, you initially have no activity in the muscles, then you start to get some reactivation of that alternate patterning of electrical activity in the muscles, and that gradually starts to improve as you continue with the treadmill training. Now, that can happen to a certain extent if you don't treadmill train an animal. You can get reactivation of these circuits, but you don't get quite the coordinated reactivation that you do with treadmill training if you don't use it. What's really interesting is not only that treadmill training improves the locomotor recovery, but if you then go on and do, well, this is, sorry, it sounds like a rather unpleasant experimental study that's been done, but if those animals then have a complete spinal cord injury, this is the sort of thing that doesn't really work particularly well in a webinar because you can't actually talk to me and tell me what you think will happen. But the question here would be, how long do you think it takes for that alternate stepping to recover? And the remarkable thing is that it'll tend to be very, very quick. So sometimes within a few hours, the animals will start stepping again. And with very relatively little treadmill training over a period of the first few days, you can get them restoring that good, organized, alternate stepping of the pelvic limbs. So it's amazing. What you're doing is by treadmill training, you are helping that central pattern generator, you're rewiring it so that it starts to take control and controls alternate stepping. And you're doing it in a way that enables it to work almost autonomously so that even though you've done this second complete spinal cord injury, it can still carry on doing the same job, walking without input from the head. So this is we can manipulate this and use it quite well actually in animals, and we do, and it's very helpful for animals, particularly those that are paraplegic. So you might think it's a bit of a struggle to get these dogs to do it, and it can be. Some temperaments are not well suited to it, but actually they tolerate it pretty well. They need support to do it, and they need help for the first few times. But by doing this sort of thing and starting them off very slowly and just spending 10 or 15 minutes with them the first time and then doing a little bit more the first day, within 2 or 3 days, dogs will start to tolerate it and you can start to see an improvement. And remember, what you're doing here is you're not magically fixing the spinal cord injury. You're rewiring. You're maximizing any benefit that you can gain from surviving nerve fibers at the site of damage, but you're also helping to manipulate that central pattern generator to improve recovery. And then as you can move on to a slightly more advanced stage, you can make it even harder for them. So you can start to put them into water and this gets them working even harder. This can a water treadmill is actually very useful for big dogs that are completely paraplegic as well, because obviously the buoyancy of the water helps to support them. And it can be quite difficult for a big dog which has got a sling on it. It can be a little bit uncomfortable for them sometimes. So this is a good thing to do. So yeah, treadmill training, very good. But if you don't have access to a treadmill, those passive manipulations, massaging, passive joint manipulations, progressive range of movement, and trying to increase the tone in the muscles are all going to be beneficial for these patients. This is an illustration of a dog that presented to us which had a perky injury, and you can see it when it arrived. It's got a bandage over its foot there because it kept on scuffing its feet. So it's got pretty good movement in the left pelvic limb, so it's got that classic asymmetric presentation, and it's largely dragging its right back leg along. So it needs a lot of help, it needs a lot of support to do this. Now we can do something straight away with that dog. One of its problems is, could you run? Yeah, thanks. Just get the next video up here. So this is us providing the dog with a bit of a splint. Now what we're aiming to do with that dog, I'm sorry, it's not the best quality video. One of the big problems that that dog has is not that it can't bear weight on its leg, because if you stand it still, it can support itself. There is enough muscle tone in its quadriceps to support it. Its big problem is it doesn't have the strength to bring its foot into the right position. And a lot of that is because its hock won't flex. And if its hock won't flex, it can't get its foot underneath itself to bear weight in an appropriate position and to get some meaningful use out of its leg. So by putting that simple splint on at its hock and holding it in a slightly flexed position, we help it to place its foot in an appropriate place. We can then start to get the dog training as well. So here we've got the same dog outside a little bit later the same day, and it's much easier to manage it. Because it's got that joint flexed, sorry, because it's got the hock joint fixed, by just a little bit of gentle pressure underneath its leg, we can push that leg forward, and there's enough extensor tone in the leg for it to support its weight. It just doesn't have the voluntary movement to get its foot into an appropriate position. But suddenly we're helping it now. We can get it there. We can reactivate, we can reinforce those pathways which have been damaged by the spinal cord injury. Now, if we move on and look at that dog. Now, this is only 24 hours later in this dog. They don't all get better this quickly, but it's a good illustration of how well they can do. So here it is walking even without that splint. And already it's regained a little bit of flexion in that hock, sufficient that with support, it can swing its leg through and it can put it into an appropriate position and it can start to walk in a relatively, it shows a good pattern of walking, even though it still lacks the strength to walk on its own. And then if we move on to a little bit later on, it looks slightly unconvincing, this, because we suddenly go from what looked like a mid-October day to what looks like the depths of winter, but actually it is only a couple of days later. And here that dog doesn't, it no longer requires support under its abdomen. It still has that extensor, and you can see there's a problem. It doesn't, it's not normal by any means, but it has enough strength in its joints to be able to flex all of its joints and place its foot into a position where it can support its weight, use its leg meaningfully, and start practicing. And once it gets to this stage, it's going to go on and do well. You have to be careful with them at this stage. This is not this dog beyond physiotherapy. Physiotherapy is still very useful for this dog, because what you need to do now, having got it to this stage, is stop it from getting into bad habits. So that means making it walk very deliberately and doing all sorts of things like sit to stands, walking over broom poles so that they really think about what they're doing with their legs. Because the sort of thing that small dogs in particular will tend to do is they'll go bunny hopping. And they'll go bunny hopping around, and that teaches them bad habits, and it can ultimately lead to a poorer recovery. So when they get to that stage, it's great because they're easier to manage and they're easier to nurse, but they still would benefit from physiotherapy because their long-term recovery can be greatly assisted by them just taking a little bit of time and making them think about what they're actually doing with their dog, with their legs. And this is just another illustration of one of the simple things that we can do to help them. Okay, in that case, that previous case with the German Shepherd, we actually had a splint that was holding the hock flexed in that slightly flexed position. But you can do clever little things like this, where it's just a bit of elasticated material here going underneath here. So this is a toe-up loop. And what it's doing is it's just helping to keep the foot in the right position so that you don't abrade the dorsal surface of the toes. You keep the foot relatively flat on the floor and enable it to walk much better, because if it can get its foot underneath itself, it can walk. Now, I did have great plans to go on and talk about what to do if there's a significant spinal cord compression, but I think I had a feeling that we'd get to the stage where we'd cover most of the conservative management, but I did think that we might struggle to get through what we do when there is compression. I guess the way I would finish off at this stage would probably be by saying that that conservative management has a massive role to play. It is the key thing for dogs that present where there is contusion but no compression. And it can also have a big impact on dogs even when they have a significant compressive lesion. The difficult thing is, of course, when you first see a dog that has an acute disc extrusion, you don't know how badly compressed it is. And of course, in an ideal world, we'd all do MRI scans and we'd see exactly what was going on. We'd visualize the degree of compression, and we'd make a balanced decision about whether or not conservative management might be appropriate. But we can't do that. We just, in a lot of cases, we don't have the money to do an MRI scan, so we just have to make a judgment. And actually, dogs with the same sort of approach to conservative management with physiotherapy, dogs can make a very good recovery. And actually, if you look closely at the literature, there are very few studies directly compare. In fact, there aren't studies that directly compare equal dogs that are equally affected where you have conservative management versus surgical management. There is a dogma, and I think it's probably right, actually, that where there's a significant compression and where the dog is non-ambulatory, that surgery is going to be the better option by a long way. But it doesn't mean it's the only option. Dogs can still do well, even with a significant compression, just with those same basic physiotherapy techniques, and doing your best to nurse them as much as possible. So I think I'll probably finish off there and see if anyone has any questions at this stage that they'd like to pose. Thanks very much. I can see some people, someone typing there. I think so. One of the questions that's just popping up is what pain relief would I tend to choose for dogs in these circumstances? Okay, so that obviously that's not a question that applies particularly to the dog with a paracute disc extrusion, but it's very important for a conventional type 1 disc extrusion where you might have really quite severe neck pain or back pain. My approach generally is to use a variety of different painkillers. So I would tend to focus on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, meloxicam, Provicox, whichever is your favorite. I often supplement that with paracetamol or paracetamol codeine combination because you can use the two together quite easily. I think gabapentin can be useful. I don't always use it, but I think particularly if you think that you have nerve root pain, then it can be a good thing to use. So these dogs where they're non-weight bearing because they look like they've got a lateralized disc problem and a pinched nerve root, they can benefit from gabapentin. And again, you can use that alongside the conventional non-steroidal and paracetamol combination as well. But of course, that's not enough in a lot of cases. So if we're in an acutely painful animal, we'd focus on using opioid analgesics, typically methadone initially if they're very uncomfortable, or the longer lasting buprenorphine as the pain starts to subside, or if they're not quite so severely affected. So for me, it's a combination of opioids and non-steroidal drugs, and gabapentin is what I would focus on. Somebody, there's another question about whether I would ever consider using steroids in these cases. The answer to that is not for acute spinal cord injury. I think these high doses of steroids are likely to be detrimental, and there's nothing to suggest any benefit whatsoever. Most of the evidence suggests the opposite. So I wouldn't use high doses of glucocorticoids in these cases. Where I think steroids do perhaps have a role is where you have chronic protruding discs in elderly animals. Conservative management of these dogs is quite feasible and they can do quite well. But it is what we seem to find is that steroids at a sort of anti-inflammatory dose will sometimes have an impact in dogs with type 2 disc protrusions and can be worth trying. Of course, you have to be careful with it because they have the predictable side effects, and it's also another unpleasant side effect of steroids, of course, is that you cause some muscle wastage. So you need to be really careful that the side effects don't outweigh the benefits. But they're definitely worth thinking about in long-standing cases. There's another question asking whether or not I use tramadol for dogs. My personal tendency is not to. I don't particularly like tramadol. I think there are pharmacokinetic reasons for being skeptical about tramadol. I know there are studies that describe using it, but actually the tramadol is not metabolized in the same way that it is in people. So it probably has very little impact as an opioid. I think any sort of painkilling effect it has is more likely related to the serotonergic effects, which is feasible. So it could have some benefit, and I think it probably does have some benefit in some dogs. But I think the side effects can be problematic. And my feeling is that a lot of dogs, it doesn't seem to agree with them. And I just don't, I for me, the benefits, the negative aspects of the drug would outweigh the benefits. It can be worth trying if you're completely stuck, but it's not a drug that I would tend to use. Somebody else has just asked a question, just touching on spinal shock, and asking if we could just briefly go over that again. So spinal shock is not something, it's not something that you're going to come across very often, but it's something that you need to be aware of in dogs that have acute injuries, because where you have acute spinal injury, you get this flaccid paralysis distal to the injury. So if you have an acute injury round about the thoracolumbar junction, the immediate impact of that is poor muscle tone in the back legs and a loss of reflexes. But that passes very quickly. So probably within an hour to 2 hours, you're going to get recovery of some of the tone, and you're going to get recovery of the patellar reflex, for example. So actually, by the time you see it, there's a good chance that the patellar reflex will have come back, and you won't see that flaccid paralysis. However, when you test the withdrawal reflex, that tends to take much longer to come back. So it can be 24, 48 hours easily, and longer in some cases, for the withdrawal reflex to come back. And that can be really misleading, because if you do your examination, if you pinch the dog's toe, you're going to see a very weak withdrawal reflex, even though you have a lesion between T3 and L3. So it can be very misleading. From my point of view, if I decide to do an MRI scan on that dog which has spinal shock, then I could be very easily lured into focusing on the L4 to S3 region, and actually then go on and miss a significant lesion much more cranially. So that's why you need to be aware of it. And I think it's particularly pertinent, as I say, for people who are in practice and who are likely to see these dogs at a much earlier stage after the injury than I will. Okay, I think there don't seem to be any more questions at the moment, so I suggest we all just leave it there and perhaps go for lunch, coffee, afternoon tea, depending on where you are. So goodbye for now.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Peter for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.